This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Stanislav Grof. How are you, Dr. Grof?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm so honored to have you. Your work is amazing. So for those people who've not read your work, give us a little bit of background about where you came from and how you got where you are before we get started.
Well, I was born and educated in Prague. I'm a psychiatrist who has done now over half a century of research of non-ordinary states of consciousness, but half of it with psychedelic substances, first at the Psychiatric Research Institute in Prague, and then I emigrated into the United States, and I was at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, where there was the last surviving psychedelic research at the time.
When was that?
I came to the United States in 1967.
Okay. All right. Well, I know that you did a lot of research with LSD and consciousness, but you sent me a paper, and so I'm going to try to focus on that paper because I understand that's what you wanted to do.
Okay.
If I don't talk about something that you want to talk about, feel free to bring that up, okay?
Okay.
But I feel first that what I should do is there's a big linguistics issue with that word consciousness, so why don't you define just what that is to you so that my listeners know where we are on the page.
Well, I was educated as a medical doctor, as a psychiatrist, and of course in the academic circle we have the idea that consciousness is something that is a side product of the complexity of neurophysiological processes in the brain, basically what's called epiphenomenon, something that emerges in the long evolution of matter. And 50 years of studying of non-ordinary states of consciousness showed me that this is basically an untenable idea, that caused something much more fundamental than that, almost like a primary attribute of existence, very much the way it's described in great Eastern spiritual philosophies. Consciousness is something that cannot be reduced to anything else, that is an integral part of existence. And consciousness is not something that's enclosed in the human skull and produced by our brain, but it's something that sort of permeates all of existence. And our individual psyche is kind of teased out of this cosmic matrix. The Swiss psychiatrist Carl Gustav Jung talked about anima mundi, the psyche of the world, this sort of intelligence and creativity permeating all of existence.
Okay. So, let me see if I can get this out properly. Is it your belief that consciousness is much more than awareness, that it's pretty much everything that is?
Well, if I look at everything I've experienced during these 50 years and I've observed in others, it would be easier to imagine, again, the way it's described in the Indian spiritual philosophies, that our experience of the material world is created by consciousness.
Okay.
Easier to imagine that matter somehow is capable of generating consciousness.
Okay, I'm with you now. I just wanted to give I've had so many definitions as to what that word is on here. I guess you probably...
We have now very, very substantive clinical evidence showing that consciousness can do things that the brain cannot possibly do. And what I have in mind is particularly the observations in near-death situations where we have for example, an operation during which the patient has a cardiac arrest, is in a state of clinical death. And at that time, when the body is being resuscitated, consciousness detaches from the body, and maybe it's observing the whole situation from the ceiling, and then decides to leave that room, go through the walls, and checks what's happening in other parts of the building, and maybe experiences something that's happening 1,000 miles away. And then if you have an open-minded researcher who then sits down with the person after the person returns to consciousness, gets the account of the experience, and then goes and checks, you'll find out that what the person is describing can be verified by people who have the gift of vision. In other words, you get what's called a consensual mm-hmm. validation. We have now observations where this happens to people not only in a state of cardiac death, but in the state of brain death, when there is no more electric activity happening in the brain. There is one particularly dramatic case history of a woman whom Dr. Michael Sabum calls Pam, who had a large aneurysm at the base of the brain. And for her to be operated, she had to be basically frozen until there was no brain activity. And this was a successful operation. And the account of the out-of-body experience that we have from her is one of the most detailed descriptions that we have. She was able to describe exactly the medical procedure, draw the instruments which were being used, and so on. And there's now also a lot of research done on people who are congenitally blind, which means they have never seen anything in their life, and this is for organic reasons. And if they are in a state of near death and consciousness leaves the body, they are capable to see the environment. And Dr. Ken Ring, who was the main researcher of this study, studies particularly what he calls veridical out-of-body experiences, which means that not only did these people see for the first time in their life, but what they saw could be validated again by people who have the capacity to see.
So you
don't have to have a medical school to know that, first of all, if you are lying on the operation table with your eyes closed, even if you are perfectly alive, you should not be able to see anything just because your eyes are closed.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly cannot see from the vantage point of view of the ceiling, and you cannot see things in rooms from which you are separated with a solid wall. And of course, you are not supposed to see when your optical system is organically damaged. So we have overwhelming evidence for this, and yet in the academic circles, we still teach that somehow consciousness, emerges out of the complexity of the neurophysiological processes in the brain, when it is highly, highly unlikely that it is so.
Well, what is it that thinks, mind or brain?
What's that?
Where does thinking going on in mind or brain? Do you think mind thinks, or do you think the brain takes information and processes it?
If you accept what I was saying before, that there is something like an anima mundi, there are thought processes which are happening outside of the human psyche. They are happening in the psyche at large, and so our individual thought processes are partially related to our life, to us individually helping us in various pragmatic situations. But we can also get into a state of consciousness where we suddenly partake in this cosmic psyche, is, again, enormous literature on what we can call higher creativity. Willis Harman wrote a book with that title, Higher Creativity, showing how, you know, musicians, writers, mathematicians, philosophers, and so on, can get into the state where they tune into cosmic consciousness, and suddenly ideas come that by far transcend anything that they are capable of in their everyday life. See, we don't have a name in English to separate those two different functions, but for example, in the German language, they distinguish Verstand, which would be sort of this ordinary everyday intellect, and then Vernunft, which would be this cosmic intellect with which we can connect under certain circumstances.
I personally had an experience similar to that. I went to bed one night. Something happened in what appeared to be a dream state, and I woke up the next morning different. And I knew that you talk about it in your book better than anybody has ever talked about it. You talked about waking up and knowing information about quantum mechanics, or waking up and being able to read health issues in people, but also thinking that you're crazy because it comes in the instant, in the blink of an eye, and you don't know where it came from. First of all, do you have an explanation of why that happened? And second of all, where does it come from?
Well, again, it's very difficult to explain if we buy the model which we are using in academic psychology and psychiatry. You need really a much, much larger model of the psyche to account for some of these processes. So, for example, after the early observations and experimentation with psychedelics, you know, I saw the limitations of the current model, which is limited to postnatal biography and then the individual unconscious, the way it was described by Freud, which is also a derivative of postnatal biography, things that we have forgotten, things that we have rejected, things that are unacceptable to us, and so on. And just observing my clients in psychedelic sessions, and then, of course, having my own psychedelic experiences, I had to vastly, vastly expand this model by adding two additional domains, vast domains, to this biographical level. The first of these additional levels I call perinatal, where we find out that there is a record of the entire process of biological birth, the memory of birth, of all its stages, with all the emotions, with all the physical sensations that we experience. And then there is yet another domain which we now call transpersonal, where we can, for example, have the experience of our personal boundaries of the body ego dissolving, and we can become one with another person, or we can become another person, or we can have experience of group consciousness, or we can identify with other life forms, anything from primates all the way down to unicellular organisms. We can also transcend time. We can suddenly find ourselves in another century, in another country, sometimes with a sense of personal remembering, what is called in psychiatry déjà vu. And then people talk about past life experiences, the sense that, you know, we had more than one life, and that what's coming now is a memory from that previous existence. And then there's another domain in this transpersonal realm, which is mythological. Carl Gustav Jung talked about archetypal realms and archetypal experiences. And this can take us into mythological regions of cultures, even cultures that we have never studied, that we don't have any intellectual knowledge from this lifetime. So there's no question that the human psyche is just infinitely larger than what we are teaching schools and universities.
Do you think How do you think we have individuality within a physical being? Is it somehow contained in our aura? Or, I know this wasn't really something that you addressed, but I've always wanted to know this question, and nobody knows or wants to comment.
Well, you know, we have, most of us identify in our everyday life with what we call body ego, or what the Hindus called nama rupa, name and shape, or Carl Gustav Jung talks about persona. You know, I'm Stan Grof, I'm Czech by origin, I'm a psychiatrist, and so on. And then we attach it to the physical body. We are kind of Newtonian objects existing in three-dimensional space and in linear time. Now, you know, most of us spend much of our life in that kind of a sense of identity or identification. But what's fascinating about these non-ordinary states that it turns out that this is something that's arbitrary, that's not absolute. These boundaries can be transcended. And we can experience ourselves as anything between the body ego and the cosmic creative principle itself, you know, whatever terminology you want to use for it. So the Hindus talked about the fact that we are not nama rupa, we are not a name and shape, that each of us carries within ourselves a kind of a divine core. And they will give you different methods if you pursue them, the different yogas. This the existence of this divine core becomes a kind of an experiential truth. It's not a belief that, you know, something like this is happening. We can experientially validate it. And then if we have the experience of this divine core, we realize that that divine core is identical with the cosmic creative energy itself, so that our identity reaches from the body ego all the way to this field of absolute consciousness, to the creative principle. And in these non-ordinary states, we can also become anything in between. So each of us can experience himself or herself as an eagle, as an elephant, as a the dancing Shiva, Jesus, and so on.
All of this stuff in mind, of course. I don't want to get somebody confused that thinking that we're talking. I mean, with fundamentalists, when I try to talk to them about this, they don't understand. It's like talking to a telephone pole.
Well, you know, you have two interpretations of Christianity. I spent a lot of time with Brother David Steindl Rath, who was from the Benedictine order. They had a hermitage about 10 miles from Esalen, where I lived for 14 years. And they also had an ashram in India, Brother Edith Griffith. And they had a very different understanding of Christianity, in which they see Jesus as a kind of pioneer in consciousness who saw and recognized his own divinity, but he was also trying to tell other people that this is the case for them. You know, you and I and Father are one. You are brothers and you are sons and daughters of God, and so on. In other words, everybody is in a sense divine and incarnate at the same time, and under certain circumstances we can recognize that, we can experience our own divinity. So this group of Benedictines, they sort of quote things from the Bible, suggesting that, you know, the original mystical Christianity was not that different of what you find in other mystical systems, like in Hinduism and so on. They mention things like, the divine kingdom does not come by expectation. The divine kingdom is here, but people don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is a divine realm, but we are not aware of it. Something has to happen with us. We have to undergo a transformation to be able to see the divinity in ordinary reality.
I want to ask a question here, and I'm a little bit off this topic, but I'm going to come back. I just don't want to forget this question. Do you think that consciousness is in gradients?
That consciousness is?
That consciousness has gradients.
Gradients?
Mm-hmm. For lack of... gradients, kind of like levels. Levels of
like
awareness.
Like degrees?
Like David Hawkins' work. You know, that book, Power versus Force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people have different levels of conscious awareness, so that there's a hierarchy, and you know...
Yeah, you know, Steve, I think one way of thinking about it, which you also find frequently in spiritual literature, makes a lot of sense to me, is to talk about different vibratory levels.
Yes.
There are certain dimensions of reality that exist on different... vibratory levels, and if you reach that level, then you experience something that was not available to you before. Very much like if you have a television set, you see every time you sort of move to another frequency, there's another reality that opens up, another experiential possibility. So there are certainly levels. I have experienced, you know, number of them over the years in different situations. So, you know, what we can perceive with our senses and extension of our senses, like telescopes and microscopes and Geiger counters and so on, is just a small fraction of reality. There are sort of normally invisible dimensions of reality that we cannot measure by any of the instruments that we have, but we can experience them personally in these non-ordinary states of consciousness.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear, but so many people have trouble with that word, frequency. You talk about in your book something that interests me a lot, and that's, you call it spiritual emergence. I know that's what we're talking about here, but when medical doctors think that you're psychotic or delusional, how do you tell the difference? How would they tell the difference between a psychotic episode?
This term, spiritual emergency, is something that came from my wife and myself after we have done a lot of psychedelic work, and then particularly when we developed what we call holotropic breathwork, when you can enter some of these states without drugs, with very, very simple means like faster breathing, powerful evocative music, some kind of body work, and so on. It suddenly became obvious that many of the spontaneous episodes of these non-ordinary states that current psychiatry considers to be manifestations of mental disease are actually a crisis of this very powerful opening in the psyche, psycho-spiritual opening, and that you can work with those states in the same way in which you would work with them if they are induced by psychedelics or they're induced by the breathwork. And you can actually discover that these states, by their very nature, are actually healing, transformative, evolutionary, or at least that they have that potential under the best of circumstances, that they are properly understood and properly supported. And then we basically came to the conclusion that there is a significant subgroup of states that current psychiatry considers to be mental diseases, which actually are these psycho-spiritual crises that can be treated in a very, very different way.
How do your peers react to that when you talk to them about that? I'm curious. I've had this episode.
It depends who it is. It's almost, you know, you have to have some experience of having experienced these states or having enough experience with others, guiding others, before you can sort of open up to this alternative. I mean, the power of the current naturalistic model is very, very strong. Although there is overwhelming evidence, if you go back to what we discussed earlier about the out-of-body experiences and so on, undermining some of the basic metaphysical assumptions of Western psychiatry, like the consciousness is the product of the brain. So we have just enormous amount of evidence. Only the academic circles don't want to look at it. And I believe that one of the reasons is that the revolution that would be necessary is just too radical. It cannot be handled by some small patchwork, you know, what we call ad hoc hypothesis, a little sort of addition here and there. It would be a major overhaul. We would have to admit that what we have been teaching all these years simply is not true, and that in many ways, for example, the great spiritual philosophies of the East had a much more accurate understanding of consciousness, the dimensions of consciousness, the human psyche, and so on, than we do, you know, with all our sort of modern technology and so on.
What does insurance companies say? It looks to me like they would have save a lot of money treating people properly that have these things.
That's very true. You know, there were actually people who started these alternative facilities where certainly the cost was just a fraction of what you, maybe one third of what you would pay in a psychiatric facility. But it's not considered to be an acceptable alternative. I mean, it's not recognized, you know, by the authorities. And so many of these alternative facilities existed very short time because they're dependent on either donations or people had to pay from their own pockets. So usually for financial reasons they would not rely.
Your holotropic breathing, does it bring about the same kind of experience as a peak experience? Can it bring that around?
When you say peak experience, you mean a Maslow?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you. The peak experience that you talk about in your book, that's a very profound spiritual experience where you wake up or enlightened.
Well, you know, peak experience is one type of a mystical experience. So it is a very, very important part of a spectrum which has also many, many other experiences. For example, two major ways of spiritual opening. One of them is through the ego death, where people can go through a profound crisis. You know, the spiritual literature talks about the dark night of the soul and so on, when people felt that they were at the end of the rope and so on, or they have a sense of really making a journey into the underworld and so on. And then suddenly there is an opening, there is a death and rebirth and so on, opening into light. So that's one type of experience. The other one is more like a kind of a dissolution of boundaries. For example, somebody can be on a trip on a raft going down the Colorado River. You know, this amazing scenery. This 1 mile of these gorgeous geological formations, which are even called Vishnu and Shiva schist, and then you can be completely overwhelmed by this beauty, and suddenly your boundaries are merging, and you don't know where the Colorado River begins and you end, and so on, and you become one with the rocks and the river and the clouds, and you dissolve sort of into the infinite, so to say.
And how does,
so those are two major categories, but there are also many, you know, subtypes and so on. So that peak experience is something that Abraham Maslow described and would be a very, very kind of a peaceful, more like just the second variety that I just described.
Oh, it's like the holotropic breathing is like the second one?
No, the holotropic breathwork can bring the whole spectrum of experiences that you can see in psychedelic sessions.
Okay.
It doesn't sort of narrow it, you know.
Because that was, for me, it was a life-saving thing, so I could imagine that what you do would be profoundly important for people with significant depression or addiction problems.
Yeah, but you cannot generalize, you know, from your experience. I don't know if you've done it in a group. We mostly do it in large groups.
It was something that I had a dark night of the soul.
Uh-huh.
And then it just popped open, or I don't know how to describe
it. But are you talking actually about doing holotropic breathwork?
Yeah, well, I've always wanted to. Once you have that experience, you seek for it again. So when I read your book, I was kind of thinking, gosh, I bet if I would do that thing, that I could have that bliss again for a few minutes, or for a few days, or for a few weeks.
Yeah, if you do something like the holotropic breathwork, you cannot go there with the idea that you want a particular experience. You see, you have to surrender, you have to open up,
mm-hmm.
you have to allow the inner healer, the inner intelligence to guide the experience. One of the things we tell people is not to go with any expectations, no plans, really just surrendering to the experience.
How would it help people who are addicted or have addictions, alcoholics and things like that?
Very much, because if you study carefully alcoholic patients and narcotic drug addicts, you can ultimately find out that behind their craving for alcohol or for drugs is really craving for transcendence. And so if they can have really clean, transcendental experience, that is a very, very significant turning point. In AA, you find out something like hitting bottom, you know, when you have a sense that you're really at the end of the road, and then you might have the experience of total annihilation, and then suddenly opening into the transcendental experience.
Do you think synchronicities are indicative of anything important?
Well, synchronicity is, first of all, is an extremely important phenomenon because it is a very important argument against the idea which you find in materialistic science that everything is determined by chains of causes and effects. It shows coincidences which cannot be explained in the traditional way. So it's showing a radically different, or a need for a radically different way of looking at reality. And for people who experience the spiritual opening that we were talking about, these synchronicities tend to kind of multiply. They start experiencing many of them in their everyday life, so that they're more and more in a kind of a numinous reality. So it's a very significant concomitant of this spiritual opening.
Are they there all the time and we just don't notice, or do they just suddenly become more active?
If you would talk with an astrologer would tell you that they are there all the time, namely correlations between what's happening to us individually, what's happening on the planet, and the movements of planets and the angular relationships between planets and so on. They would see the whole universe scheme as being basically permeated by synchronicity.
Do you think that there are any kind of indications that you're about to have a dark night of the soul, that if you paid attention that you could avoid having that dark night of the soul?
What do you mean, indications? A warning? Or?
Yeah, relationships may come and go, or illnesses come and go, or...
I think the many, many different triggers of these experiences, but basically there's one common denominator to all of them, which is normally, as long as things are working out for us, you know, we are in a good relationship, we have sort of certain plans and hopes for our family, things are going well in our professional life, we pursue certain goals and we are successful and so on, and the situation in the world looks hopeful, then we are kind of taken away from our inner life, and we invest a lot into the external world. Now, to the extent to which the external world starts collapsing for us, we lose important relationships, either by breaking relationships or by death of close people and so on, and we start experiencing failures. The economic system is collapsing. We lose a job and so on. Then we, don't have this force that's driving us forward in the world, and we are kind of thrown back on our own psyche, and we start sort of basically regressing, sinking into our psyche, and then it becomes a process of spiritual opening. So there is this sort of a negative relationship, between how much you invest in the external world and how deep you can experience yourself. For example, the whole Western civilization is very much oriented outwards. We expect, happiness and satisfaction from something that's going to come in the form of a material success of some sort. And there's very little appreciation for any kind of deep inner self-exploration or probing.
Do you think we have complete free will?
Those are difficult questions.
Well, the reason
the answer would depend on who you think you are. I mentioned before that in these non-ordinary states, you can experience yourself as the body ego,
mm-hmm.
as your persona, as your nama rupa, or you can also go all the way to the largest identity, where you identify with the cosmic creative principle. So you would feel more and more determined as you are taking on these narrower roles. You would experience more freedom as you are sort of expanding your sense of identity.
I guess the reason I ask that question is because all the movies that are out, The Bleep, The Secret, all those things, talking about creating, my next question was going to be, do you think thought creates? They always talk about how you can create whatever you want. But if we had complete free will like that and we could do those things, then you could say, Eva, meet me at Starbucks at 3 o'clock, and we'd be there at 3 o'clock. We wouldn't get lost, and it wouldn't be 5 minutes till, and it wouldn't be 5 minutes after, and we wouldn't have a flat, or we wouldn't forget. So I just don't really think we have complete free will in everyday physical reality, and I wondered what you thought about that.
No, again, I would have to answer. It depends on the level of consciousness you're operating in. If you are fully identified with your physical self, then you have very limited freedom.
Okay.
But it's conceivable, as you are moving to this higher level of consciousness, that the range of your possibilities increases.
Interesting. That's a good way to perceive it. What about, do you think thought creates?
Do what?
Do you think thought creates? In other words, do you think we create our own reality, like we're creating 6 months from now today with mind?
Yep. I think that we have a very significant role, individually and also collectively, in shaping and creating reality. The way we perceive the world, the way we sort of imagine what will happen and so on. All those can become very important factors. But I think in the kind of New Age circles, these things usually get sort of kind of blown out of proportion. And without the recognition of the fact that the situation would change depending on the levels of consciousness that you have experienced, the levels of consciousness on which you operate, and so on. And you make these generalizing statements, you create your own reality, or you created your own disease, and so on.
What role do you think that you were talking earlier about pre-birth memories? What role do you think that plays in our daily lives?
Extremely important. You know, if you do this inner work, whether it's with the breath work or with psychedelics or with some systematic spiritual practice and so on, you will find out that the way you operate today is very significantly determined by what happened to you in childhood, in infancy, you know, what kind of parents you had, what kind of family, what kind of psychosexual traumas happened to you, and so on. And the process doesn't stop there. As you go deeper, then, you find out that you are very strongly determined by the circumstances of your birth, whether your birth lasted 5 hours or 50 hours. And you died in the birth canal and had to be resuscitated, or forceps was used, and so on. Or whether you were born by a cesarean section. And many people discover there are also significant things that happened in their prenatal life that can have tremendous influence. For example, growing up in the womb of the mother who doesn't want you, surviving attempted abortions and so on, all that is recorded and has certainly an influence on who we are, how we feel, how we perceive the world, and so on.
When you say
and it has the quality of what I would use to, I would use a word from computer, from the computer world. It has the quality of a program, of a software. In other words, it's negotiable, it's changeable, it's not hardwired in the brain. So you can go back there, you can bring it into consciousness, you can relive it, you can express the emotions, you can express the pent-up physical energies, and your life, your current life, will change as a result of that.
Do you think that it's necessary? Well, that's not a good way to phrase this question. Your holotropic breathing, if it brings about a spiritual emergence, lets probably 20 years of conventional psychotherapy of talking about it instantaneously go away. Is that right? That's kind of the impression that I get about it.
Well, it's a much more powerful way of working on yourself if you do if you work with some experiential method. Obviously, the most powerful would be psychedelic substances. Also, the most problematic. You have to be most careful about setting and the right circumstances and so on. Because the more powerful something is, the more possible side effects you have. If you have a method that's not very effective, it's not also it's not going to hurt anybody. So then next would be the breath work. The breath work is a situation where you have much more control than you have in a psychedelic session, because in a sense you have to work for getting further into your psyche. You have to do the breathing, and you can decide to slow down the breathing, and you are in control of the process. Whereas if you use psychedelics when you swallow the substance, you don't have any more control over it. And then if you are dealing with something like meditation or gestalt therapy, again, you are moving in the direction of techniques that will take more time, but also in some sense are safer.
Do you think that we'll ever have those kinds of drugs available to the general public to do that kind of work?
Well, you know, there has been tremendous change recently, just in recent months.
I don't know.
A number of new psychedelic projects. There's a large project happening in Switzerland, in Zurich, in the University of Zurich, where they're exploring several psychedelic substances. There are several programs in the United States now, both with a substance called psilocybin, which is the active alkaloid of the magic mushrooms. And actually several of these projects are repeating the work that we did with dying cancer patients. You know, helping people with the fear of death and also with the pain, sometimes even pain that's not responding to narcotics. So there are several of these projects going on right now, which is a tremendous change. There was like a 30-year break there. There's also the studies of substance called ecstasy or MDMA with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yes, I know about that one. Have you found that there are more spiritual emergences happening in the last decade or so than before in time? And if you do, because I kind of think that the Noetic Sciences just did a project on that. What do you think that means for the world?
I certainly have that feeling. There are polls suggesting that people are reporting either having more mystical experiences or reporting more mystical experiences, whether or not they are having problems with them, which would define them as spiritual emergencies there. But I believe it has something to do with the kind of an escalating crisis in the world. You know, the world is certainly very different from what it was 30 years ago. And we are running now a whole number of kind of doomsday scenarios. You know, in a sense, we are living in a period of history which is unprecedented, where the human species can destroy itself for the first time. And you know, we have several different ways to do it. So it seems that we are approaching now a situation where we either are going to go through some powerful transformation of the human species, or we might not. Make it. And I think the incidence of mystical experiences and spiritual crisis is just a symptom of this general development.
I'd like for you to, at this, we got about 7 or 8 minutes left, take a few minutes and tell people where they can find you, because you have numerous books. You can list them if you like. Otherwise, at least tell them where they can find you, where they can find your institute.
Well, I think the best way would be to go to our website, which is very easy to remember. It's holotropic.com, HOLOTROPIC.com. And also, if they just write my name, that would, you know, this website will be one of the first things that will appear when you Google it.
Is there anything that you particularly would like to talk about?
Well, I think, you know, if people who listen to it, they would like to have the experience. We have trained over 1,000 facilitators now all over the world who can conduct these holotropic breathwork workshops. It's much more interesting for people if they can have a personal experience rather than, you know, hearing somebody talking about it. So this is usually done in groups. And in this group, you will be having the experience yourself. You also be sitting for your partner, and then in the sharing group, you will hear stories of a number of people you know, what happens during the training. So that for people who haven't had this non-ordinary experience, that's a very, very safe and very available way. We have ourselves a training for facilitators that people, you know, that people can take. You will find all the information on that website, holotropic.com. There's also on the website, there's also a list of my books and articles and so on that people can read if they are interested in this whole area.
What do you think, what brings about sudden emergence of psychic abilities and intuitive abilities? How does that happen?
Well, it is one of the types of the psycho-spiritual crisis, of the psycho-spiritual opening. You know, there are many, many different forms. So one, for example, the spiritual opening has the form of what's described in Indian literature as kundalini, awakening of the serpent power. For other people, it can take the form of shamanic initiation and so on. So this kind of a psychic opening is just one type of the crisis, where people usually have number of synchronicities, out-of-body experiences. They can start having telepathic experiences, precognitive experiences, and so on.
Another question I have, when we talk about vibratory frequency raising or lowering, what is it that's raising or lowering? Where's the frequency? The frequency of what? I mean, I understand what it means, but
we usually use that term frequency for the material world. For example, the electromagnetic spectrum, and each part of the spectrum has its own frequency. So we have, you know, infrared light, red light, and all the way to violet, ultraviolet light, and then we have microwaves and X-rays and so on. Those are all different frequencies, and this is something that you can measure. And we have actually devices that can register these frequencies. The same frequencies in the radio, in the television set. Now, what we are talking about in this inner world cannot be measured. At least we don't have any instruments that can measure it. It more reflects the something that you experience. It's a subjective experience of moving to a realm which has a higher frequency.
Is it our aura, or is it just mind that's permeating us?
No, I think the aura would be a very specific phenomenon. What I'm talking about would be very general.
Okay.
Very general characteristic of certain states of consciousness. And on each of those levels of consciousness, you can have a number of phenomena happening.
Okay. And how do you think Big Mind or Source communicates with us individually? Would it be through frequencies, like kind of like cell signaling? Maybe does it send impulses through the?
Say it once more. How does the Source?
Yes, the Creator, the source of intention, or the source of creativity, or God, whatever you want to call it. How does information get from there to us?
Well, you know, I think that we are so much influenced by living in the world of technology that we want to use naturalistic models, you know, very concrete models. I think that once you get to the kind of phenomena that you are talking about, you are outside of the realm of physics. We talked about the fact that, you know, all the boundaries in the universe are arbitrary, including the boundaries between us and the divine. So all it takes is the dissolution of those boundaries, and we can communicate with the source.
Yes.
But
like
I don't think that at least at this point we don't have any concrete radiation or waves that
mm-hmm.
That we could identify as a medium. It seems like it's happening in the world of consciousness itself.
Yes, it does. Let's see if there's anything else that I want to make sure that I cover. I guess one thing that I want to make sure is clear to the listeners is that because this happens to someone, it doesn't mean that they have a mental disease, right?
Well, I mentioned, we wrote two books that people can read. It's co-written by my wife, Christina, and one of those books is called Spiritual Emergency, and the second book is called The Stormy Search for the Self. Both of them are published by Putnam Publishing Company. And so we have written, in those books everything that we know about this phenomenon. So this would be probably something where people could find a lot of useful information.
Are they still available?
Yes, they should be. There
okay.
shouldn't be any problem, yes.
Get them off Amazon?
You certainly get them from the Amazon.
Okay. And another thing I wanted to discuss with you just briefly, because we've got about a minute left. These kind of experiences have nothing to do with religion, right?
Well, what I have been talking about and writing about are spiritual experiences. You see, and this spirituality is very different from religion. Every great religion started from spiritual experiences. The founders, the prophets, the early followers and so on, they all had experiences like the experiences that we are talking about. But once the religion gets organized, it very frequently moves away from this direct spiritual source and becomes preoccupied with secular things, with money, possessions, power, politics, and so on. And you can end up with a religion that has no spirituality in it. Or you can be very spiritual, but have no religion. So when we talk, for example, about transpersonal psychology, which is a psychology that's trying to bring together the best of science and the best of spirituality and showing that there is no conflict between those two, we are not talking about reconciling religious dogma and science, whether the science is old science or new science. We are talking about the mystical experiences. And there's nothing unscientific about studying these experiences, their phenomenology,
mm-hmm.
how they change people, and so on.
Well, we're about out of time, but thank you so much for coming on my show. And take one more minute to tell everybody where to find you one last time.
Thank you again for having me.
So they can find you at holotropic.com?
Holotropic.com. There's also my personal website, which is my full name, StanislavGrof.com. And it's written together, StanislavGrof, the whole name, .com, or holotropic.com. Those are two different websites. The holotropic.com is related more to the workshops and the training that we do, whereas my personal workshop has a lot of different articles and interviews and, a lot of material that people can find.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Grof. I really am glad to have you.
Thank you again.
And good night.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.